writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
Hello, everybody. It's been a while. It's been a minute.
It has been a while, yes.
So, Kim, you're back.
I am back.
Japan.
Yeah.
So, I have to know, how was Japan?
It was amazing. It was like going to such a civilized country. It was just like, wow, and this works, and this works, and they don't have this problem. Wow. And I'm sure if I lived there and I spoke Japanese and I was more in tune with various issues and the politics and all that, that I would have things that they are doing wrong. But from a tourist perspective, they've got it all right.
Okay, give me one example.
So we got ourselves what's called a JR Rail Pass. If you don't live in Japan and you're staying there, you can buy one for 1, 2, or 3 weeks. And it allows you to ride the majority of trains for free. So like we'd want to go like a long distance, say, you know, several hundred miles, okay? And we'd show up at the train station, and they had these really super fast trains called Shinkansen, which are, you know, up to 200 miles per hour trains.
Oh.
And so you show up, you're in the, just in the regular station, you go to the counter person and say, I need to go to Kyoto from here. And they're like, okay, do you need your seats together? And then, yeah, can, okay. All right, so there's a train leaving in 15 minutes. They give you your passes for where you're going to sit. You walk down to the platform. The train pulls up exactly on time. You walk into the train. You sit down in your seats, and it starts going, and it just whisks you there. And we did one that would have been like a whole day of transport if we take it a car, or like probably an hour and a half plane ride to get from these two places, and it was about a 4-hour train ride. But you didn't have to go to the airport ahead of time. You didn't have to do security. You didn't have to do all that sitting around and that long time where everyone funnels in because, you know, everyone comes on the plane at the same time, and it's all really tight. But the train's much wider and more spacious. Like, you know, 30 or 40 people get on a car at a time, and they just all get in their seats, and the train takes off right on time.
Nice.
Or, like, there was no trash anywhere.
That's nice.
It was so clean. And the toilets. The toilets are amazing.
What did they describe them?
So you sit down, and there's, like, this panel of buttons. And you can wash your various parts. There's one button for your butt and one button if you're a female. And the seats are heated. And I'm talking about like, you know, standard public toilets that you might go into.
What?
Very clean toilets and lots of them.
So it's bidet.
Yes, it has a bidet function as well. And also some of them have air.
They can blow
you dry afterwards.
What? How do they stay so clean?
There are people out there that clean. Like, I watched a garbage truck going through, and they don't really have garbage cans. They just leave them in bags on the sidewalk just before they're going to be picked up. And sometimes they put like a netting on top so somebody doesn't get it. But basically, the garbage man came in, and they were throwing them in. And afterwards, one of the garbage men had a dustbin and a sweeper, and he would just sweep up any extra little bit of garbage that might have fallen out.
Wow.
Yeah.
Go Japan.
Yes.
This is an example of we know how to make things fair and functional. We just choose not to. But Japan chose to.
Well, Japan people like to follow rules.
I like to follow rules.
They also think that different. Also, there was no smoking. And apparently that's a recent thing.
There was no smoking like anywhere?
Pretty much anywhere.
Like how, what did smokers do? Did
they just... Well, we were in one hotel that had like a room that was a smoking room. Or
so people do smoke there.
People do smoke. But the thing is, we were there previously. People smoked all the time and everywhere.
Mm.
And I was talking to our friend there, and she was saying, well, this is a set of rules that had come down about 2 or 3 years ago for the Olympics. they basically went from having people smoking and doing all this stuff to basically having people stop. Like, stop smoking in public places, stop smoking in restaurants. There were some restaurants that were officially smoking restaurants or bars. But, you know, the people just follow the rules. Someone says, you don't do such and such, and they don't do that.
Wow.
They say, you don't litter. And people put, then they have trash, they put it in a little bag in their backpack, and they take it home with them.
There's no trash bins anywhere?
There are very few trash bins.
So you just keep your trash?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you can locate one along the way or whatever, but, you know, you just have a bag back there, so if you finish, you know, with whatever you've been eating, you just stick it back in there and you...
It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
It makes you more conscientious about what you're carrying with you, what you're eating, what, you know, all that stuff, because you have to carry it.
And you don't have, like, overfilled trash cans everywhere and stuff. Because, like, if you have a trash can that's overfilled, and then people keep trying to stuff stuff in, and then there's trash around it, and then there's pigeons and stuff like that. There were very few pigeons.
Huh. Interesting. Yep. So... favorite museum?
Well, we didn't go to that many museums. We went to the Studio Ghibli Museum, which was amazing. We're big Miyazaki fans, so that was pretty awesome. One of my favorite places was still this island off Hiroshima City called Miyajima Island. You take a little ferry to get there, and it's very touristy, but they have, like, these deer that they let run everywhere, and they're very small deer with spots on the back, so they all look like fawns.
They look like Bambi.
Yes. Aww. And they're not afraid of people at all, so they walk right up to you.
Did you pet them?
Well, I didn't really pet them because they're wild. But like, there's one that basically stuck its nose right in at a certain point. And it has a beautiful hiking trail to go up to the top to look out over the ocean and such. It was pretty foggy, but that was great. Just very charming and delightful.
All right. Favorite meal?
We went out for sushi at the Japanese fish market where it was super fresh. You don't like fish.
That's okay, but
do. But it doesn't smell at all like fish.
Okay.
And the textures are amazing. Like, we had shrimp, and it had this silky, smooth, chewy texture.
Is it the best you've ever eaten? Best sushi you've
ever eaten? Oh, definitely the best sushi I've ever eaten. Yeah.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Nice. All right. Well.
You want to ask me what's the worst thing?
Oh, what was the worst thing?
Land leeches.
What the hell's a land leech?
It's this leech that lives in the water when it rains, but it doesn't live in a pond. It's out and about when it's raining, and we were in one area.
They're like earthworms.
Really fast-moving earthworms that can actually, like, kind of track you.
What?
And they're super tough, and so what happens is you step on them on your shoe, and they stick to your shoe, and they don't get smushed. And then once they're on their shoe, they start crawling up and they go for the first bit of skin they can find.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Oh, God.
And then you can't feel when they bite. So they just sit there.
Ew.
And then when you finally see them pull them off, there's an anticoagulase. So you start bleeding for like 20 minutes after that.
That's horrific.
I know.
It's disgusting.
It is.
What? They're not. They don't carry diseases and shit, do they?
No, no, no. They're not carrying diseases, but they... were awful.
Were they everywhere?
Just one location on one rainy day.
Oh my God.
But that was enough. We all got them, and Magic got them like 5 times.
Ew! Were they slimy?
No, not terribly slimy. Okay. But like I said, we had one of them where he picked it off like I was going to squish it. And I squeezed and I squeezed. Yay! And I put a napkin and I squished it, and it was just fine.
Oh! Didn't even have the... decency to die.
Did you ever see Princess Mononoke?
Yeah.
Do you remember like the curse thing that would get on and would just wriggle and stuff like that and would kind of fall off and it would wriggle and go back and all that?
Yeah.
That's what they were like. Smaller, but like that.
It was like from Wrath of Khan, that little thing that wiggles into your ear.
Something like that. Oh my God, if it was in my ear. So.
I could feel it like in my brain and then it.
Anyone going to Japan, going to Nikko on a rainy day, like, duct tape your pants to your legs.
You need gaiters.
Yes, people were wearing gaiters. I could tell why they were wearing gaiters.
Smart. Mm-hmm. Smart. Anyway, so. That did you take pictures of them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got a little video one.
All right. Well, I just want to thank Kim publicly for my gift. She got me a, what are they called again?
Gachapon.
And it's kind of like back in the day, I don't know if they still sell them, but they're like little clear, almost like eggs. And then you would put like 50 cents in and then they would come out and it would be like an eraser or some shit. Right. Well, Kim came back with a Japanese version, which is like way better than the stuff that we would have like at the pizza joint. Right. And it is a space cat. I open it and it is space cat, a cat with a bubble helmet.
Orange space suit.
And I'm.
If Buck Rogers had a cat.
Dude. This, it's awesome. I don't even know. I might have to name it Kim. But it's pretty awesome. Like, if I got anything from Japan, I didn't even know that existed. And now that I know and that it's mine, mm-hmm. my life is fulfilled.
I think for our photograph for this one, we need to have the book in front of the space cat.
Yes. Book in front of the space cat. Everyone, check out my space cat on our website.
And speaking about that, what about reading?
Oh, yeah. We forgot. So this is a podcast about reading, writing advice books and discussing them, which we have yet to do. So let's perhaps get started.
And just because it's been a while, we are reading Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird, and we are in the section entitled
The Writing Frame of Mind.
Yes. Previously, we had two chapters in this that we didn't really think too much about because they were kind of nebulous and weird and such.
Yeah.
But there are three more chapters in it. And these ones I found to be really good.
Yeah.
A bit weird in certain parts, but really good.
That's a theme. So it's like she's got some good advice in a few sentences. Either you kind of sandwiched in the beginning and at the end, maybe sprinkled in the middle. But then throughout it is this weird stuff. Kind of reminds me of Ambrosia. You never had Ambrosia? I think it's maybe called different things. So it's like this weird whip, and then you put oranges in it and grapes and other stuff, and it's like pink and it's creamy and it's got marshmallow and it's disgusting.
And you bring it to potlucks.
Yes, and then you serve it at Thanksgiving. And
you make it up in a giant ice cream tub?
I don't know about an ice cream tub, but it just comes in a big bowl.
Okay, so people.
And the only person that ate it was my mom and her mom. And then when her mom died, it was only mom, and mom would keep making it, and nobody's eating it but her. And it was like, mom, stop. It's like the Jell-O of the time. Anyway.
There's some odd writing in here.
Yeah, so this I feel like it's kind of Ambrosia.
So first chapter is called Broccoli. When I originally saw this chapter, my assumption was to be a chapter about how to eat your broccoli and how you had to do certain things that you didn't necessarily want but were healthy for you as a writer.
Do you like broccoli?
I don't mind broccoli, but as a kid, that was definitely, you know, you have to eat your broccoli. Or rather, I have children, and I have one child who I have to tell that, yes, he has to eat the broccoli. At least the tree part.
At least the tree part. So in the beginning, she says, there's an old Mel Brooks routine on the flip side of the 2,000-year-old man where the psychiatrist tells his patient, listen to your broccoli, and your broccoli will tell you how to eat it. So that's a metaphor for, what was the metaphor?
Broccoli is what she calls intuition. It's that little voice that gives you ideas in your story, that gives you the really good plots and ideas. But that, she says, we don't necessarily listen to.
We lost access to our broccoli when we were children, she says.
So, I mean, similar to some certain artists that were like really trying to get back to a more childlike approach to art, where mm-hmm. it's playful. It's not analytical and do it properly and this should all be very serious because you're a serious writer. It's like just tapping into your intuition. Are you an intuitive writer?
I have actually this problem. So it's intuition versus the rational mind, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My rational mind gets in the way all the time and I don't trust my intuition, which, by the way, is something women are trained not to do. To trust their intuition, and it gets you in trouble. Anyway, it certainly did me. This one really spoke to me. She says, so you may have gotten into the habit of doubting the voice that was telling you quite clearly what was really going on. It is essential that you get it back. You need your broccoli in order to write well. Otherwise, you're going to sit down in the morning and have only your rational mind to guide you. And then she goes in this description about how you'll sit down, and if you use your rational mind to guide you while you're writing, you'll sit there for 20 minutes and get really frustrated and get up and leave, when if you had just sat there for a while, the answer or whatever you were working on will come to you. But your rational mind is telling you that it's not working, and then you didn't get your writing done that day, and then you come back the next day, and you tell yourself it's going to happen again, and it does. So you're not listening to your intuition. You're not trusting yourself that the answer will come to you or that the writing will work itself out.
Is that kind of what she's saying?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much exactly what she's saying.
I'm kind of wondering, though, so she picked broccoli as a metaphor. Is there a better metaphor? Like, well, if you had one.
Another person refers to, my animal thinks this, my animal hates that. I don't know. I mean, I think I like intuition.
Okay. But I think of it more like a gremlin. Sounds like a little gremlin, you know? It's like, you're no good.
No. So that's the opposite. The broccoli is the
intuition. Oh, the intuition.
Like, yeah, it's like, this is what has to happen in the story. Or this is what I'm going to do, and it's going to work out.
Ah, it's the, like, thing you trust.
Yeah. Like, I once wrote the novella about the haunted house.
Yeah.
And a lot of that stuff was just kind of intuition and just kind of a feel. It just sort of unfurled in my brain. It's like, I'm going to go with it. And that story has kind of a weird meandering, weaving around sort of thing. And it worked. Or maybe the ending doesn't quite work. I might not have quite nailed the ending. But, like, everything up at that point, it was an intuition. It wasn't an analytical thing.
Right. My brain does that a lot. And I spend a lot of money on therapy and supplements and listen to a lot of podcasts trying to shut up my rational mind and listen to my intuition. Currently, I am doing art. I haven't showed Kim yet.
You showed me a little bit, yeah.
Oh, did I?
Okay. Yeah, because I know the artist you're working
with. Oh, that's right. That's right. So I've been drawing from this book that says you can draw in 30 days. And my mom was a very, very good artist. And she always used to say things like, my kids never got the art gene. And thinking back, I realized, well, none of it was really nurtured at all. Like, we were not given books to draw. We were not given art supplies. And thinking back, it's like, okay, maybe
she didn't come and turn off the TV and said, okay, guys, let's do artwork.
The TV was, that was our babysitter. It was everything.
This drawing guy that you got has actually had a PBS show where he taught how to draw. But I'm guessing that she didn't turn the channel to PBS.
Oh, no. She did not turn the... Well, we watched LeVar Burton, you know, Reading Rainbow. But, yeah. No. We never watched that. Anyway, so somebody recently encouraged me. Be like, hey, you may have actually gotten the gene. It's just not fostered or whatever. And so I got the book. And wow! In 15 days, I can now not tell people that I could barely draw a stick figure. Because now I can draw a house and a rose and a koala. And it's delightful. And it gave me access to this thing called beginner's mind. I don't know. You probably guys know that. But I lost access to what it felt like. I had a memory of beginner's mind. And, you know, I remember when it was fun to write poetry and stuff. But then you learn too much. And then it's not fun anymore. And with the art, it's fun. Because it's beginner's mind. It's like, oh, I haven't felt this. It is nice to have a reminder.
So your broccoli is your beginner's mind.
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
There's one other quote I love here, which is, writing is about hypnotizing yourself into believing in yourself, getting some work done, and then unhypnotizing yourself and going over the material coldly. And I think that's the idea. You know, you write a whole bunch of stuff, and then your analytical mind, all that stuff you learned, does get to have a chance to play out. That's what you do after you get the initial stuff down.
Yes. You flip between your rational and irrational mind.
A lot of writing advice tends to follow certain patterns because it works. And this, to me, seems a lot like idea behind NaNoWriMo or something, where you turn off your editor's brain and you just write. And here, you turn on your broccoli and you just write.
Right. Like she says, you train yourself to hear that small inner voice and be naive enough to get it all down on paper. That seems to sum it up.
Yeah, just accept whatever you're going to put down on paper and just go for it.
Do you do this?
I found that actually handwriting
helps
me a lot. When I'm handwriting, I just don't have that same, things must be perfect, this isn't working out, I don't like this. I'm just a lot more loose and I tend to have ideas. And then I kind of use that to prime myself and then I'm better for typing stuff up. But my issue is actually this next chapter, which is radio station KFKD.
Or K-fucked. yeah.
If you're not careful, station K-fuck will play in your head 24 hours a day, nonstop, in stereo. Out of the right speaker in your inner ear will come this endless stream of self-aggrandizement. I might not pronounce that right, but anyway. And the recitations of one's specialness, of how much more open and gifted and brilliant and knowing and misunderstood and humble one is. Out of the left speaker will be the rap song of self-loathing, the lists of all the things that one doesn't do well, all the mistakes one has made today and over an entire lifetime, the doubt, the assertion that everything that one touches turns to shit, that one doesn't do relationships well, that one is in every way a fraud, incapable of selfless love, that one has no talent or insight, and on and on and on. And when we talk about, like, you know, the ambrosia and stuff, like, it's this stuff. She kind of just goes off on tangents.
It's the marshmallows and the weird cream and shit, where we're looking for the oranges and the grapes.
But that's what happens. Like, one part of my brain is like, I'm writing my novel. It's a fantastic novel. This is going to be great. And the other part is saying, that sentence sucks. This doesn't make sense. Yada, yada, yada. And there's no space in between those voices to actually get down and get stuff on paper.
Yeah.
And that's my issue.
That is also my issue. I have that same problem. Neuroses, yeah, yeah. I pay good money for therapy.
It's not just you're beating yourself up all the time. It's that there's other parts of you that are fantasizing about how fantastic it's going to be when you publish this thing.
There's a lot of weird going on. I mean, is this the same for artists? Like, why is it that writing is so hard? I guess they call it the tortured artist for a reason.
It's the Ira Glass one about when you have developed a mind or a...
The gap.
The gap. When you have learned how to recognize really good writing or whatever particular art form you're in, and you can look at your stuff and see that it's not there, and there's that gap. And I think that when you are more trained in an area, you notice that gap. So when I sit down to do artwork, since I'm not really trained there, it's like, oh, this is great. I'm drawing a house, you know. I'm drawing a koala. Fantastic. I think that a professional artist knows what a really good koala looks like, and they know that they have to compete against those koalas. But the
koala's been done before. Yeah. And they can't do it in a new way. Oh, maybe they can. Oh, but they can't. But they can. Oh, they'll be celebrated for their koala drawing skills. But then, oh, no, they've all been done. Oh, this is so stupid.
Look, the new animal is the octopus.
Yes.
I think this probably... especially with social media and stuff like that, I think this gets to everyone. But our particular area is writing, so that's how we understand it.
I see. So this is the tortured artist. The things that torture the artist is K-Fucked radio station. It's on play all the time. She doesn't say the word meditation, but it's still in here. Like you feel it's still in here.
I totally feel that. And I find that the best thing I can do to turn off the station is to spend some time meditating and quieting my brain.
Right.
She also recommends the whole breathing for a period to center yourself.
And that's a meditation thing, too.
It's a meditation thing, too, yeah.
She just doesn't say the word meditation.
The other aspect that I thought really fit with me was the fact that I know that meditation helps, but that I still fall off the wagon so easily because there's other stuff to do. And she talks about how one day she thought she had throat cancer and two of her students were doctors in her class and yada, 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 whatever. But one of them recommended hot water to drink for her sore throat. And at the break, the doctor brought me a cup of boiling water as though for tea, but without the tea bag, and I drank it. My throat and chest stopped aching about 20 seconds later. I hate that. Still, breathing calmly can help you get into a position where the workings of your characters, hearts, and da-da-da-da. So it's like, I know I need to meditate. I hate doing it, or I always have something better to do, and I don't get around to it, and I think this is fits right there. It's like, you know, there is a technique that works. If I remember to do it, if I force myself to do it, it will decrease the brain chatter.
Right, right. Then we get to the best chapter, which ends this whole section. And then we get into part three.
Yeah. And I think this is up there with the one that everybody reads, Shitty First Drafts.
Right.
This one has a lot of hard truth in it. And the next chapter is called Jealousy.
Jealousy.
This is a fabulous chapter, if only because she goes really deep on her jealousy issues and how hard it was to get over it. I loved it because it wasn't just a pithy, you just gotta let everyone do their own thing and just let it go and it'll be happier for it. It's like, no, listen, this is how much it can screw with your mind. This is how hard it is to get rid of. This is how shitty it makes you feel. And you know what? There's even more.
Yeah, she was very self-deprecating in here, which I appreciate. I thought it was fun. She says, jealousy is one of the occupational hazards of being a writer and the most degrading.
She also says, jealousy is such a direct attack on whatever measure of confidence you've been able to muster.
Yeah.
The other one is, you feel, once again, like the kid outside the candy store window.
Yeah.
So the story is, she talked about jealousy by saying that one particular writer friend got the best book deal ever. Lots of money. And the lady was losing friends left and right. I wonder why. Because she was like constantly like talking about her successes and not always in a great way. And it really annoyed Lamott because she was super jealous that this other writer got all this stuff that she has yet to get or hasn't gotten. And so she tried to like deal with like, how do you deal with it when your friend makes it? Who's a writer? They make it and you have yet to make it. Mm-hmm. How do you talk to them on the phone and not feel jealous?
This is one of those more advanced writer problems, because when you're first starting out, you usually pick a writer group and everybody kind of sucks together.
Yeah.
Also, nobody's getting a publishing deal. No one's having anyone pay attention to their writing. Maybe one person decides to self-publish, but you don't feel too bad about that because, you know, that's a lot of work. And you go to a writer's group and maybe people have done self-publishing or really tiny presses, and you don't feel too bad because that isn't what your goal in your head is to get.
Right.
But I think this comes down to, as you get better in your writing, you will acquire more serious writers around you. You'll acquire more people that are really serious about being published and being published by a major publisher, and they'll put the effort into it and they will follow up with the queries. And eventually somebody you know who's writing you like, but maybe don't think is any better than yours and maybe worse, is going to get a book deal.
Right.
And that hasn't happened to me personally.
I know people who've gotten book deals, but I wasn't really jealous of them. They were just writing something completely different than I was writing, and just different
right.
goals.
Or
and...
if you have a friend who's an absolutely amazing writer and they get a book deal, that's not so hard to deal with because they always were that good.
Yeah.
Yeah. But when the other person isn't as good as you as a writer.
Or at least you don't think they are.
Right.
Yeah.
Then it gets hard.
So we were thinking about it, or at least Kim made me think about when I was jealous. But first, let's start with you. Has this ever happened to you? Do you have this? Is this like real, like this whole jealousy of other writers and how it consumes you inside?
So, like I said, I haven't gotten to the spot where I really have been competing with other writers for the thing I want. But I will say that when I was in grad school, there are people that you're directly comparing yourself to. And for our program, we had like internships or things like that. Overall, we all got along great. And we're very positive, but there were things where only certain people get picked for certain things. So that's the closest I've been to a situation where it was possible to feel this kind of jealousy. And like I said, for the majority of people in my program, I had no issues. They were fantastic writers. They were working their butts off. And the other thing that I think really helped was that in my program, everybody that was there, this was their second career. Their first goal was to be a scientist and to be this prestigious academic position, and every one of us had gotten to the point where we realized we're not going to be that, so maybe we'll try science communication. So even though they were brilliant, amazing, several people had PhDs, this was all everyone's kind of second choice, and we're going to do as good as we could, but there's a certain humility. Nobody's a wonder kid that's just like flying through. Everyone's had a few bumps. But there was in the program one person, and they were that kind of hungry, ambitious sort of person that was also very unaware of how they affected other people or some of the things that they said.
Okay.
And that person was sometimes kind of hard to deal with because they would have certain successes and they would talk as if they earned and they deserved and wasn't it great that they had it without thinking that because there are only so many limited things, that meant somebody else in the program wasn't getting that.
Right.
It was the central thing of this woman that Lamont says that shows that really this wasn't just Lamont being jealous. The other woman was constantly bringing up how much money she had, never paying attention that Lamont, a single mother, was not having much money and was actually struggling.
Right.
And more than just somebody that had less talent than you doing better than you, the issue was that they weren't aware that you were struggling too.
Right. They're just so big about sharing their success.
Yes.
And wanting to talk about how successful and awesome everything is.
Mm-hmm. And in the end, the biggest thing that she did was she cut this person out of her life.
Right. And suddenly the problem went away. So sometimes it's, yes, it is part you, but sometimes it's the other person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I've dealt with stuff like that too. I don't think I have ever felt like
jealous in the degrading kind of jealousy she's talking about with another writer in school. But I will say I have felt it for trying to get a full-time job as a college instructor. That ate me up inside, and I eventually had to quit. I just had to leave because, you know, you're one of hundreds of applicants. I had gotten really close many times. There was always some reason that leaked out from somebody that's not supposed to tell me. I would somehow find out why. And I'm like, that is completely out of my control. Like, you know, it's like, what? And there was too many things that happened like that. There were so many things out of my control. But then I would get jealous of certain people that somehow were able to control the factors. One of which was married to someone in the department. And lo and behold, they get a full-time job in that same department, at that same school. It's like, okay, I guess I married the wrong person. But then you did. I did. The first time.
Yes.
But see how that's the jealousy coming out? I married the wrong person. Right, like, that's jealousy. That's the degrading kind of jealousy popping out of my mouth right there.
And just for the record, we're referring to her first husband, not her current wonderful
one. Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes. We're talking about the practice marriage, not the good one. Yeah. So, I love you, Max. Then it continued because I keep trying. In another college, a couple people on the committee, the full timers, they were rooting for me, and they had hired quote unquote an algorithm to go through and pick out the applications. And so I put in my application and they said, we didn't see it. And I'm like, what? And then they're trying to tell me all this advice about how to like fix my freaking cover letter and all the shit to fit the algorithm. And I'm like, I know how to freaking do that. So the next time there's a full-time position, I try it again. They could not find my application again. I'm like, what is going on? I made sure all those keywords are in there. And then they're like, we don't think you're filling it out correctly. Perhaps a mistake has been made. So I had a full-timer actually watch me as I submitted the application online the way I'm supposed to and the way I'd always done it. And she goes, yeah, that's what I would have done.
Didn't show up?
Nope. You know what happened?
What?
This is the reason. This is one of the biggest reasons. This is the icing on the cake.
This is the reason why we are friends and doing this wonderful podcast together, because of this one insignificant thing that derailed you.
Well, no, it added it up. I've reached the end now where I'm sick and tired of putting all these full-time materials together, which take a long time, dear reader, and essentially pushed me off the cliff. I found out that somebody in HR was throwing my application away because my confer date on the transcript that I was submitting wasn't there.
Your what?
Confer date. It's a stamp that says this is the date on which you received your degree. Because the transcript document I was using was right before I got that. So I didn't use the official one. I used one that I used to get hired as an adjunct.
Yeah.
And I had used it to get hired at three different schools. All of them hired me, but for some reason, they were rejecting it in the application. Somebody was picking it up and going, ha ha, she did it again. And no one's telling me what's going on. Okay, I'm really angry. I will never not be angry about this. I've been on like six full-time interviews. And when I found out about this, where they didn't even check out my application, I'm like, so wait. Legally, if I'm supposed to have this confer date on there, how am I getting hired? So what you're telling me is I'm good enough to be an adjunct. My transcript is somehow good enough to be an adjunct.
To not give you health care and give you really bad classes.
No job security, blah, blah, blah.
But
someone's just going to throw your application out. And that little, I was so mad. I was like, what the hell? This is bullshit, right? Like bullshit. Anyway, you hear all the jealousy. I have friends who've gotten their full-time jobs and I just wasn't getting it.
The issue is when somebody else has success and they're not obviously gifted or talented any more than you are, and you see them having success and you don't have success, it just plays with your mind and you can't even focus on necessarily the self-improvement that you need to make, because it doesn't even matter, because look at this person and how well they're doing. And this kind of stuff, it just wrecks you.
Yep.
You can't be a writer if you've got this kind of stuff sitting in you. How are you going to actually start typing anything up on the page when you've got all this weighing you down?
Right. It's like there's factors outside of your control
that are determining things. Mm-hmm. And if that is you being an artist or being a writer, it is to get published or be in an art gallery or whatever. And your friend somehow was in control or the cards aligned their way. And sometimes it doesn't align for you. And that's a hard pill to swallow.
She says, "And I, who have been the Leona Hemsley of jealousy, have come to believe that the only things that help you ease or transform it are A, getting older, B, talking about it until the fever breaks, and C, using it as material."
Right.
Getting older, it does help. Like when you're 20, this stuff is devastating. When you're 40, you have lived longer. You've seen kind of the way things cycle. Things don't matter as much when you get older in certain ways that they do when you're 20.
You just take things less seriously.
You just have to, because you've just had so many experiences and you just don't have the bandwidth for it anymore.
There's a lot of power in the shrug.
Yeah.
You know, the, what are you going to do? This has happened a million times. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. And things like meditation, stuff like that, do help you work through it because you learn to train your brain not to dwell on it.
Yeah.
And to move on.
One tactic has been helpful. I've been listening to this app that Kim recommended called Healthy Minds. It's free. And it's really good. I'm surprised it's free. I have no idea why it's free.
Because it's part of a university program.
Well, thank you, university program. Anyway, so I listen to it more often now. I've gotten a lot more better about keeping up with it. And one of them I really like, really worked for me, which was naming the thought I was having. And what it did, oddly, immediately showed me how ridiculous I am to myself. For example, after that long rant, if that was a thought, because sometimes you play that story out in your head, if that was a thought and I was being mindful, I would be like, I'm replaying the story about how I didn't get the full-time job at Evergreen, you know, like...
How many years ago?
I'm still angry about that. And I'm playing out this story to myself. Why? To get angry. I'm angry. How do I feel right now? I wonder what triggered that. Huh. And then, oh, I'm doing dishes. Oh, yeah. I like my dishes. Fiesta plateware. That's when you know you've made the middle class, is when you got the Fiesta. And then you just keep naming your thoughts. Oh, I'm telling the story about mom again, and I'm feeling depressed. Well, yeah, your mom just died. You kind of feel a little depressed. It's okay. It's cool. You don't have to go to that story. You can just be a little depressed for a little while. And oh, yeah, Fiesta dishware. For some reason, the naming of the thought that I'm having would break the spell, and it would take me away from getting swept up in that whole story I've created.
And that's basically age and having more perspective on stuff.
And having a friend who gives you a free app.
Yeah, and then there's C, talking about it until the fever breaks. And sometimes you just need to rant.
Yeah, but I told the story so many times. Like, dear listener, there's somebody out there who has told their story to different people, maybe. Don't do it to the same person over and over again. They will not be your friend anymore. But you have the story. It's almost like you've memorized it and it comes out exact same way every time. At what point does telling the story ever going to break the spell? Because every time you tell the story, it's actually getting a bigger grip on you. So yes, sometimes letting it off your chest is nice. I would argue that's why you pay a therapist, because you're actually going to get a response that makes sense.
Well, the other thing she says, as far as like repeating to people, was that it wasn't something where she said it to somebody and then she just got off her chest. It was incremental. It was like, you know, telling somebody and having them like commiserate in a way that made it a little bit better, or having them suggest something that made it a little better. She has another piece of the solution came when a poem by Cliff James called "The Book of My Enemy Has Been Remaindered" appeared in one Sunday in the New York Times book review. And remainder is when bookstores can buy a whole bunch of bestseller or books they think will be bestsellers. And if they aren't bestsellers, they can ship them back to the book company and the book company will pay them the price that they sent. It's the reason why bookstores can be in business, because they don't actually have to eat the bad books that they buy. And so it's a delightful poem. We'll link it in the website. But it talks about this guy's books all going to this warehouse and these lauded books and all the things people set critics say. And it's still sitting next to, you know, some book about fly fishing. And just the delight that schadenfreude. And she said that helped a lot.
This is one quote I really liked. Said, I was raised in a culture that promotes this competitiveness, this insatiability, this fantasy of needing hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and then, in the next breath, shames you for any feelings of longing or envy or fear that it will always be someone else's turn. I was only doing what I had been groomed to do.
I think the idea is that that kind of jealousy is not something that's going to go away all at once. It's not something you can will yourself to go away. Like, you don't want to get obsessed, like you said.
Right.
Discussing it, going over it, as long as you're not, like, completely spiraling.
Right.
And then the final one, which is use it as material. And I will say that this one individual from my program was unique enough in their particular fallouts or things that they missed or some of the things that they did in class that showed that they really weren't paying attention to what's going on or getting the signals from other people on how to behave. And I filed all that away, and I will have characters that have certain those traits. In a way, I sort of absorbed aspects of them to be used later in my stories. And that helps because suddenly it's no longer this person out there that's irritating me, as more as something I have in my tool palette to use at some point. Because it's a bit of mine.
Yeah, so it would be kind of like me creating a character that feels like the world is out of their control, like their fate is out of their control, and that the world just keeps affecting them. So I could create a character that does that, but then, like, maybe highlight everything a little bit more because it's a character.
Or put them in a space shuttle at the time when everything's falling apart.
Oh, yeah.
And use all those emotions in a completely different setting.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. What Kim said.
Academia is too scary as it is.
Oh, academia.
Anyway.
It was a bitter pill, but it's good that someone else is also swallowing it.
So many people are swallowing it, and that in the end, you know, she just took a sabbatical from the friendship.
Yeah, sometimes it's the friend. And then sometimes you quit the job, which is what I did. And now we have a podcast.
And now we have a podcast.
Ooh, way better. I mean, dear listener, we're not really getting paid. So I didn't exactly get the full-time job stuff with the podcast, obviously. But we do have a tip jar.
You do. And we do have a Patreon account. You know, we're not going to do a extra thing this time. This has been kind of our catch-up session.
Right.
But since we've segued so perfectly.
Since we segued so perfectly, we do have a Patreon account. And we got lots of bonus episodes. Very helpful stuff for writers, we think. Mm-hmm. We've got lots of articles on there, study guide stuff, snark notes, I called them. We've also got a tip jar. That's a very simple thing to do. All you got to do is go to the website. And on the top right of the website, it says tip jar. And you can just tip us. It's cool. Buy us a coffee, man. A candy bar. My husband likes this cookie place in Santa Cruz. You can buy him a cookie. That would be really cool.
The other thing we have is a process group.
So today, there's one today. We're both going to be there.
Yes, we are.
So, yeah, we've been having it the whole time. And it's been really, really cool.
It was in the process group that one of the people who is a blogger mentioned that she had self-published a book and she was in Santa Cruz. And I said, well, have you dropped it off at the bookstore in Santa Cruz, because they will do, it's not commissions, it's when they don't buy the book, but you can display it if it sells. And then I was looking through my bookshop Santa Cruz, and they had a little newsletter at the tail end. They said, like, here are some local authors, and there was her book.
Woohoo!
So, yeah, I think that talking to other people and hearing their suggestions and applying them, it can be a great thing. And several people in the process group also went on a writing retreat, right?
Yep, they went on a writing retreat. Somebody, Joe, you got, like, an award recently for two pieces. Yeah, man. Like, it's, you know, we don't just talk about our problems. We talk about our successes. And
in a way that doesn't make you jealous.
Yes. Everybody is very supportive and sweet. And there's no pills to swallow, actually. It's really just nice to just hang out with other writers for a little while.
So go to our website, wordstowritebypodcast.com, and you'll see the schedule for when we do our process groups.
Yeah. Just click the poster. It'll take you to the meetup.
Okay. I think that is a long episode. We'll call it that. And
we'll call it that.
Yeah.
Welcome back, Kim.
Thank you. While I don't think Japan would be a best trip for Renee because there's a lot of fish.
I don't eat fish.
Yeah. I will say it was a fantastic trip. Anyone listening to this wants advice for going to Japan, just come email me because I've got all the knowledge right now.
Thanks for the space cat, Kim.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you guys so much. And we will be back in 2 weeks because we are back on schedule.
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
like, why don't they just teach me some freaking middle class skills already so I can goddamn insurance already. Cut all of this out, Kim. Cut it out. I can't stop. I'm done. We're done.